From the end of 1984 through the spring of 85, a serial rapist preyed on the campus of Texas Tech. Each incident was reported with eerily similar details, including the fifth attack on a 20-year-old student who helped put together a composite sketch and underwent a rape kit. Meanwhile, Tim Cole, a new student at Texas Tech, arrived in the spring semester after the serial rapes had already begun. From a passing glance, a plainclothes detective decided that Tim resembled a composite sketch. A suggestive photo lineup led to Tim's misidentification, arrest, and sexual assault charges, solely for the fifth attack in the series. An additional rape occurred the day after he was taken into custody. Further, the rapist had smoked during all of the attacks, while Tim, a chronic asthma sufferer, had never smoked. The judge refused to admit evidence that this attack was part of a series that was also connected to a man who was then in custody. Without these exculpatory details, Tim was convicted on the victim's shaky testimony of, quote, "I think that's him." After the statute of limitations expired, the serial rapist confessed but was ignored. DNA testing would eventually prove Tim's innocence, but not before complications from asthma tragically took his life. We're joined by his brother Corey and sister Karen, who share their journey to posthumously exonerate Tim and restore his honor. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today, you're going to hear a story that is unlike any we've ever told on this show. And I have to be honest, as I was reviewing the research on this case that I've known about for a long time this morning, I'm not a very emotional guy, but I was fighting back tears. And soon you'll understand why. But there's a lot of hope in this story, too. And I hope that you'll take that away from this episode and from the extraordinary people that we have the privilege of having on the show with us today. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce the brother and sister of the man who was wrongfully convicted. His name was Tim Cole. He's not with us anymore, but his brother and sister are very much alive and are absolute warriors for justice. So, Karen, we're going to introduce you first. Karen Kennard is a shareholder in the government law and policy group at Greenberg Traurig, and she does quite a bit of pro bono innocence work. So, Karen, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be here today.
And we also have Tim Cole's brother here, Corey Session, who's vice president of the Innocence Project of Texas. Corey, I'm just super happy and honored to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And during our time today, we're going to get to the extraordinary work that each of you are doing and how much that would have meant to your brother. I only wish he was alive to see it, honestly. And if we look back in time to back in 1985, your brother Tim Cole was in his mid-20s. He previously attended 2 years of college, then joined the Army, where he spent the next 2 years before going back to school in 1985, attending Texas Tech, and set to major in political science. So first, before we go any further, can each of you just tell us a little about what your childhood was like and about your brother Tim's early life, your memories of him growing up? Karen, let's go to you first.
Well, Tim was the oldest child in our family. We are a blended family, mother, stepfather, seven children, six boys, and I'm the only girl in that family.
Wow.
Tim's the oldest, and I'm the second oldest. My memories of our family is that, you know, it was a happy childhood. We were fortunate. We had two hardworking, loving parents who tried to do everything they could to give us what I call a normal childhood. We grew up on a street called Hillview Drive, and there were like two other families with seven kids on Hillview Drive and lots of other families with other kids. Tim was very well liked. He loved basketball. He took being a big brother very seriously. He was very responsive and responsible for us. I think all of us, when he first went off to college, remember receiving letters from him. He liked to write us letters, give us advice, check in on us, make sure we were on the right track. And those are some of the fondest memories I have of him just being a guardian of us.
And Corey, my understanding is that he was never in any sort of trouble, right? So he would have seemed to be, for a number of reasons, he would have seemed to be one of the least likely people in the entire town, or maybe even the state, to have committed such a horrific crime. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Tim was a quiet person. He was a peacemaker. I'll tell you one of the memories I have. I think I may have been 6 or 7 years old, but I remember this vividly. And this will tell you the type of person Tim was. It's a summer night. We were outside in front of our house, and there had to be probably 15 kids out there. And the topic people were talking about was, what do you have to do to get to heaven? And they were going around the circle. Yeah, you got to do this. You have to do that. Well, Tim was sitting at the edge of the driveway with his hands around his knees. Tim's nickname was Ears. And one of the older kids said, Ears, what you think? And it was very quiet. And my brother Tim said three things. Just do right. And there was a pause. Then all of a sudden, there was an uproar of, yeah, okay. Leave it to Ears to make it simple and keep it simple. Just do right.
Yeah, I've never heard it said in such quiet, simple, sort of eloquent terms, but what a good thing to be known for and remembered by. And he lived it, right? He was not just talking the talk, he was walking the walk, serving his country, serving his family, I would say, right?
Yeah, because he joined the army specifically to help our family. I mean, we were seven kids, and we were starting to have anywhere from 3 to 4 kids in college. He called me one night and said, you know, I'm doing this because I know I can get some college benefits. And he said, I want to help mother and my stepdad. He was always about trying to figure out how to help us, how to help the family, how to help all of us.
Yeah, he was serving his family, his community, and his country. And that brings us to the fall of 1984 through 85, when a rapist had been terrorizing the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, having already victimized 4 women with the same MO each time, right? The women had been taken from parking lots near campus, driven to desolate areas, and raped. The assailant usually smoked cigarettes during the assaults and then would flee on foot. Now, on March 24th, 1985, the 5th abduction and rape involved a young student named Michelle Murray Mallon, just 20 years old at the time. Now, normally we do not mention sexual assault survivors' names here. However, Michelle is very vocal and open about her story. She was parking at a lot across from her dorm when a man approached asking for help to jumpstart his car. When she told him that she didn't have any jumper cables, the man reached in through her window and unlocked the car door. Miss Mallon screamed and bit his thumb, but the man held a knife to her throat while he moved into the driver's seat and drove her to a vacant field outside of town, where he forced her to perform oral sex and then raped her. He then drove the car back to Lubbock, where he took $2 in cash, a ring, and a watch from Miss Mallon before leaving on foot, as he had done in all the other crimes. Ms. Mallon called the police to report the attack. A rape kit was done, and she helped investigators with a composite sketch. Now, Tim, once again, was a student at Texas Tech at the time, but he was home on the night of the attack studying. His brother was hosting a card game, so there were 5 different alibi witnesses, all of whom were there with Tim. I mean, this story obviously should have ended right there, but it didn't. So, Corey, were you the one that was hosting the card game?
I was not. I was still in high school, but my brother Reggie was the one who was also at Texas Tech at that time, who was hosting the card game. Like you said, the atmosphere at Texas Tech, there's a rapist loose on campus. Parents were withdrawing their children out of school because they couldn't catch this person. So the temperature was high. We've got to find someone. Tim had a car. One of their roommates worked at the Mr. Gaddy's Pizza. And his roommate called him to come pick him up. And he said, sure, I'll go pick you up. Mind you, this is daytime. He went down there to pick him up, saw a young lady walking outside, paid no attention, went inside. His roommate came out and said, hey, Urs, I'm not going to be able to get off right away. Can you come back? He said, yeah. Well, that time, that young lady was sitting in the restaurant. Tim got up, walked back to his car, got in his car. That young lady was walking down the sidewalk, and she had made eye contact with him while in the restaurant. And she looked at him, so he let down his window and said, do you need a ride somewhere? And she said, no. And he said, are you sure? And she said, yes. He said, well, Here. He pulled out his driver's license. He said, my name is Tim Cole. And he showed her his driver's license. And then he went and pulled out his Texas Tech ID. He said, you don't have to be afraid of me. I go to Texas Tech. And she said, okay. And he said, you sure you don't need anything? She said, no. He said, okay. And he drove off. Well, that lady was a undercover police officer named Joanna Bagby. And she immediately reported to her supervisors, that's him. And the supervisor says, how do you know that's him? She said, because he looks like the sketch. That was it. Now, Tim had reported his wallet being stolen. And they had no picture of Tim in the system. So they found his name that he had reported. So they knew his address. So they went to his address, knocked on the door, and told him, hey, we may have a witness who knows who stole your wallet. But we need to make sure that you are the person. Can we get a picture of you? And he says, sure. So they took a Polaroid picture outside of his apartment. And that's the one that they put in the six-pack, one Polaroid, and five other black and white photos.
One Polaroid. I just want to repeat that. And five other black and white photos. Let's just pause there for a second, shall we? Because this is one of those techniques that police use that is highly suggestive to make one photo stand out from the others. Other cases we've seen, there was only one person in handcuffs. Or again, in another case, there was a single picture in a photo array that was circled with red, like a red marker.
So they took the photo, they put it in the lineup, and Michelle vividly remembers being shown the spread. And she pointed at Tim and said, I think that's him. But the detective wrote near the photo, that's him. And that's what they ran with. Came back to his apartment, they arrested Tim. Reggie says he heard Tim say, no, y'all got the wrong person. I haven't raped anybody. And the police took him and he told Reggie, call mother. That night, my mom flew to Lubbock to bond Tim out of jail, took him back home to Fort Worth. And she got a phone call from the attorney she had retained, a gentleman by the name of Mike Brown. And he said, Ms. Session, I was calling to see if you guys made it home okay. She said, yeah, we did. He said, well, I got some bad news. There's been another rape today. And she said, oh, Mike, I'm sorry to hear that. He said, well, not only that, they picked out Tim again. And there was no way possible that he could have committed the rape.
Right. He was either in police custody or in Fort Worth when that day's rape had occurred. But he was identified nonetheless.
When it comes to eyewitness identification, the best type of eyewitness identification to perform is a double-blind procedure, which is not done at that time and is still not done in a lot of cases.
Yeah, a double-blind procedure is a very straightforward way of removing suggestion from the process, where the person administering the procedure will show the photos one at a time and not say anything, not make any suggestive comments. You simply say the person who committed the crime may or may not be in this lineup that I'm about to show you, and then show the person the photos while keeping your mouth shut. Because even a well-meaning interviewer, if they have their own preconceived notion about who it is, they're going to steer somebody. It can be subconsciously, and it might be something as subtle but still powerful as, well, keep trying, or you're doing a good job. I know how difficult this is for you, but maybe you want to take one more shot at it. Anything like that can be the difference between life and death for somebody, and between getting the right or the wrong person, or nobody at all. And the research that's been done has shown that simple changes like instituting double blinds drastically reduces the incidences of wrongful identifications, while not, and this is critical, while not reducing the instances of correct identifications. Right? So it's like there's literally only an upside here. And the Innocence Project is leading the charge to try to institute double-blind IDs as policy across the country. And for your brother's sake, I wish this had been the policy back then, not to mention the fact that he was in police custody and therefore he couldn't have been in two places at once. He could not have committed the sixth rape. And they knew that.
You also want to remember, the rapes happened before Tim got to Lubbock. The rapes started happening in the fall of 1984. Tim didn't get to Lubbock until the spring semester started in mid-January of 1985. And there were several of the victims who did not pick him out of any photo array or any of the live lineups, but the police, once that undercover officer said those words of "that's him," became convinced that it was him.
You can't be in two places at the same time. Tim could not have been either in police custody or in transit to Fort Worth with your mom while also out there committing the sixth rape. Just like he could not have committed the initial four rapes before even coming to Lubbock to attend Texas Tech or be at home studying during your brother Reggie's card game while Michelle Mallon was raped. And I have to say, I really feel for Reggie too, right? Because imagine what that would be like and how it must have impacted him having known definitively that Tim was innocent, because he was right there with him at the time.
It drastically changed Reggie's life. He has felt responsible for a long, long time for everything that happened to Tim. And it took him over 25 years, took him a lot of therapy to finally recognize that it wasn't his fault. He's doing fine now, but it took him a long, long time.
So the investigation was a bad mockery of an investigation, I would say. The description, of course, had some glaring errors in it as well. When I say that, the victim, who's white, and we know that cross-racial identifications are the most error-prone, they're less accurate than guessing. And yes, you heard me correctly. And that's been proven in study after study. So she was white, and she described her attacker to police as a young African-American man with bug eyes. Did your brother have bug eyes?
No.
Okay, and he was under 6 feet tall, the attacker, according to her initial description, wearing a yellow shirt and sandals. How tall was Tim, and did he own any kind of clothing such as that?
Tim stood 6'1". The victim recounted that the person wore a yellow terry cloth shirt, and she remembers it because she always hated terry cloth shirts. They did collect a yellow shirt from my brother's possessions, however, it was not a terry cloth shirt.
And she didn't give a lot of other details. I mean, the poor woman was obviously traumatized, but she did say, and this piece of the identification is unmistakable, right? She said the perpetrator had smoked cigarettes throughout the attack. Now, there's something about your brother where this should have right now set off all kinds of warning signals. Karen, what am I talking about?
Tim had asthma. He was born an asthmatic, had had problems with his asthma all his life, and did not smoke cigarettes.
So even though the MO was consistent throughout, and police had believed all along that the same person had committed all six rapes, Tim was arrested and charged with the aggravated sexual assault just of Miss Mallon and none of the other rapes. Now, here's something I'm struggling with, considering the nature of these crimes. Tim was offered a plea bargain with no prison time.
Yes, the district attorney at that time, a man by the name of Jim Bob Darnell, the day before trial, told him, "You were facing 25 years in prison. We're going to offer you probation." And Tim said, "I'd rather spend 25 years in prison before I ever admit to something I did not do." And Mr. Darnell very smugly said, "Well, we aim to make sure that happens."
If they believe that your brother was responsible for even one of these rapes, this is a black man in Texas accused of raping a white woman, do you think that they would have offered him probation?
No, not a chance in hell. There is no way they would have offered him probation. And let me just say, unlike a lot of these cases, my parents hired a very good lawyer. We were fortunate in that there were resources to do that. He did a really good job of investigating. And so we knew there was a police officer from the university who had told them that they had the wrong person, that Tim was not the person who had raped this young woman, that the Texas Tech Police Department gave them the name of who they thought the person was.
And mind you also, when they arrested Tim, they announced in the media, the radio, print, electronic media, that they had caught the tech rapist. They just did not want to say, "Oops, sorry, yeah. Tim, we got the wrong person." The attorney, Mike Brown, was very confident that they were going to drop the charges. He'd be found innocent because they had actually arrested another guy who had committed rapes with this same MO. And other attorneys were like, oh, yeah, that'll be taken care of. But they did not want to relinquish the fact that we got him and we're going to keep him. When that trial started, it was a media circus, and my mom brought some of the newspaper clippings and things home. Tech rapists, caught tech rapists, all of these things.
Now the trial begins in September of 1986. Remember, this is before DNA testing, so they only had serology testing in which you can determine blood types and whether or not the source of any bodily fluids is a secretor, meaning the blood type can be identified in all bodily fluids, not just blood. So the forensic examiners for the state had examined the rape kit and had identified a type A blood secretor on the swab. However, the victim was a type A secretor. And Tim also had type A blood, but his secretor status was unknown. So therefore, the serology offered no meaningful conclusions at all. They also compared foreign pubic hairs collected from the victim to those from Tim and said that they had similar characteristics, but that they couldn't draw firm conclusions. So the biological evidence really offered very little to work with. Corey, what else happened at trial?
Michelle Mallon went on the witness stand and was asked, do you see the man in the courtroom that you said raped you? She said, I think that's him. And Tim being an asthmatic, that's brought up, can't smoke. She never knew that Tim was an asthmatic and couldn't smoke. The bite that she put on the actual perpetrator's thumb, there were no bite marks on Tim.
I mean, this is a woman who's literally fighting for her life. She didn't know whether she was going to survive this attack or not when she bit him. So she probably meant to take that finger clean off. How the hell would that not leave a mark?
And you have to remember, it was 1 week between when she was assaulted and when Tim was arrested. They didn't find any bite marks on him.
So what about Tim's alibi witness testimony? Weren't there five alibi witnesses at your brother Reggie's card game?
There was a vigorous defense with all of the alibi witnesses who were very certain that Tim was there that night. They were saying, you know, he was the studious one. He didn't join in the card game. They said he told him he had a test.
When my brother Reggie testified, he was very certain and forceful that Tim did not do this. Tim was at home, and the prosecutor said he was being very brash. He'll say anything to protect his brother. Well, Reggie, when he got through testifying, Mike Brown, the attorney, grabbed him and took him outside and said, Reggie, I want you to listen to me very carefully. I want you to go down this hallway. I want you to go down the back steps, all the way downstairs, and go out the back door. My secretary is waiting for you. She's going to take you to the airport. You're going to get on the plane, and you're not to come back to Lubbock. The Lubbock police were going to charge Reggie with one of the rapes of the tech rapist.
Just for him defending my brother.
Reggie remembers vividly Tim telling him, they got me. Don't let them get you.
That is just fucking terrifying.
Michelle, when we talked to her, she told my mother, Ms. Session, I remember this because the rape crisis counselor told me, you know, they're going to arrest his brother, too, for the other rapes.
These people just don't give a shit about truth, justice, or anything. And just when you thought this couldn't get any worse, that brings us to Jerry Wayne Johnson.
It was a Perry Mason moment when my brother's attorney, Mike Brown, said who the rapist was. Jerry Wayne Johnson. Mike Brown wanted to introduce evidence showing the similarities in all the other rapes, but the judge denied it. He denied every time he would try and bring those things up about Jerry Wayne Johnson, then threatened to hold the attorney in contempt of court.
The judge did not allow evidence that there was this string of other attacks where there was this MO of what the perpetrator was doing, approaching victims on foot, smoking and all of the attacks. The judge didn't allow evidence of that into the trial. And if that evidence may have been admitted into the trial, that would have been stronger evidence in my brother's favor, in addition to the alibi evidence that he had.
Absolutely. Not to mention, if DNA testing had been available to do what it eventually did in this case. So Karen, what happened next? I mean, I can't imagine what all of this was like for you and your family.
because Corey and I had a couple other brothers still in school at that time. My dad stayed home with them so that they could continue school. So I was the only person who actually sat through that 1 week trial. It was a 1 week trial, a full week. And I call it the week of hell. Started that Monday morning and it went all the way through Friday. They came back late Friday afternoon with that verdict.
So you were there for the verdict. What was that moment like?
You know, took our breath away. They were out for a long time that day. And so we were hopeful because he had been offered probation. So we thought maybe there'd be a hung jury. Maybe they'll come back with not guilty. We knew that we had a good lawyer who had put on the best case he could with what the judge had allowed him to put into evidence. And that Tim had been a good witness for himself. He was earnest. He was forthcoming. And we had laid it all on the table. But when that guilty verdict came back, it was a gut punch.
I remember I was 17. I was a freshman at UT Austin. And I remember my mom calling me, telling me they convicted Tim. And I was like, how? And that weekend, we all came home except for Tim. And it was probably 2 a.m. in the morning. And it was very quiet, except for my mother walking back and forth down the hallway, screaming, swinging her hands back and forth, talking to God, saying, why did you let them do this to him? You know he's not guilty. Just back and forth, back and forth. And I got up and woke my dad up. And he went to the hallway. And he put his arm around her and he said, come on, Ruby. And he walked her to her side of the bed. And I was standing in the hallway just looking at her. She seemed to still be in this trance. Even when our grandmother passed away, when my dad passed away, I didn't see her in that much pain. And my mother always prayed from day one, let whoever did this, let them come forward. And decades later, her prayer came true. The day Tim was sentenced to 25 years, he was taken into custody and put in the cells in Lubbock County. And there was a man across from him in another cell who heard Tim crying. I didn't do this. Why'd you let this happen? Talking to God. And this man, who happened to be Jerry Wayne Johnson, said at that point, something in him told him one day he was going to have to make it right. We believe him on that because jail records show he was in custody and he was in the same general area as Tim, so he could have heard him. And then 10 years later, he actually writes letters to the judge, to the prosecutors, to our defense attorney, admitting his guilt. And he would do whatever it took to clear Tim's name.
It's extraordinary. So Jerry Wayne Johnson, in 1995, after the statute of limitations of his 1985 rape had expired, he wrote to judges and the prosecutor, the Lubbock DA we mentioned before, Jim Bob Darnell, as well as to Mike Brown, that he had committed the rape that Tim was convicted of. Johnson, by this time, was serving a life plus 99-year sentence after convictions for two of the other sexual assaults, which were almost identical in terms of characteristics to the one that Tim was convicted of. So ultimately, even though one would think that they would admit their mistake now that the actual perpetrator was confessing, Johnson's letters were not even acknowledged. Meanwhile, Tim remained in prison and was offered parole, but only if he would admit to guilt, and he refused. Twice during his prison term, due to his extremely serious asthma condition, he was found unconscious in his cell. Tim was left to suffer with this condition in a place where the condition would only worsen, and the symptoms would obviously be exacerbated due to the various deprivations of a Texas prison cell. And ultimately, after 13 long years in prison, Tim's system just couldn't take it anymore. And on December 2nd, 1999, he died in a Texas prison cell that he never should have set foot in the first place. I remember when it happened. because it sent shockwaves through the Innocence community. And I remember feeling a sense of outrage that I had not experienced that particular emotion before, because it just struck me as so freaking wrong, you know, that I'd heard of all sorts of wrongful convictions and all sorts of injustices, but this one, I think, hit a lot of us really hard, still does to this day. And the year after Tim died, Johnson wrote again to a supervising judge. This time, the case was moved to a different judge and rejected without comment. But eventually, in May 2007, Johnson's most recent confession letter reached the Innocence Project of Texas and your family.
At the Innocence Project, we receive hundreds of letters a month. But rarely do you receive a letter from someone admitting their guilt and wanting to exonerate another party.
So the Innocence Project of Texas sought posthumous DNA testing in the case, and Lubbock prosecutors this time cooperated. So how did all of this take place?
A young man by the name of Elliot Blackburn, he was a government reporter with the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, took a call from me about a letter we had received, and he said, "I'm interested, send it to me." And I said, "Just so you know, this letter is from the person who committed the rapes, and he was mentioned at trial." 1 week later, he wrote a story in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal. And the reporter, as well as the Innocence Project, a very good attorney named Jeff Blackburn, pushed Matt Pyle, who was the then district attorney of Lubbock, to do DNA testing. And the reporter caught him on a Saturday at a softball game for his son, and he quoted him as saying, "We will do whatever it takes to prove Tim Cole's guilt or innocence." And we hadn't heard anything for months. And Elliot, the reporter, called and said, "Corey, I got some news, and it's big. They got the DNA test back, and they've been sitting on it for over a month." I called my mother, and I said, "Mother, Elliot's on the phone. They got the DNA test back." And he said, "Miss Session, the DNA excludes Tim, and it matches Jerry Wayne Johnson." And my mother said, "Well, now you all know. When they said they found the rape kit and there was enough to test back in January of 2008, we actually celebrated then because we knew." So we were a little bit subdued when they're like, "Okay, well, now you know what I've always known."
Get this. The victim in this case, Michelle Mallon, courageously speaks and writes about this case to raise awareness about misidentifications and wrongful convictions. A direct quote from her, she said this at Georgetown University Law, "I was positive at the time that it was him. I was shocked when I found out it wasn't him. I joined Tim's family in working to exonerate him because it was the right thing to do. Timothy didn't deserve what he got." End quote. Mic drop. Wow. Michelle, so much respect for you.
So Matt Pyle, the district attorney, was very much, "Well, as far as I'm concerned, he's cleared." No. My mother said, "I want his good name back for the annals of Texas history to show that Tim Cole was innocent." So Jeff Blackburn requested a hearing in Lubbock, knowing full well they would deny it because no deceased person had ever had an exoneration hearing in Texas. And Jeff Blackburn had used his expertise and knowledge of the Texas Constitution and statutes to use a little known procedure called a court of inquiry, which allows you to seek redress in any county in the state of Texas, regardless of your conviction, if you can show just cause that you were wrong. And in the 299th District Court in Travis County, Judge Baird agreed to have a hearing, and we requested that Jerry Wayne Johnson be bench warranted to the hearing.
So during a 2-day hearing in February of 2009, Johnson again confessed to the crime, this time before a judge, before your family, and before the victim.
It was very surreal, I can tell you. My brothers, a couple of them, were real angry. So there were quite a few bailiffs in the courtroom. So there were going to be some disorder in the court. And I remember my brother Kevin was sitting literally on my brother Sean, because Sean went into the military because Tim went into the military, and he was going to jump over the bar. And so he had to hold Sean down because he was visibly shaken and emotional. But as my mother said, if I'm not angry, no one can be angry.
Nobody's
and no one can be angry for me. She knew that Tim had a greater purpose.
And the greater purpose became clear. And I want to, of course, mention the Innocence Project of New York joined with the Innocence Project of Texas as co-counsel on the case.
And let me just say that the Innocence Project of New York found the letter that Tim wrote to them in 1992 asking for assistance and returned that letter to my mother.
Barry Scheck, I can't say enough about him.
Yeah.
Took time out, came and co-counseled on Tim because it was so important that we have finally proven in these United States that the innocent do in fact die in prison. But Tim, in many of his letters to us and to my mother, he always said, I want three things: vindication, exoneration, and a full pardon. The vindication came with the DNA testing. The exoneration came through the 299th District Court, who Judge Baird said he was factually and morally innocent. And this was the worst miscarriage of justice he had ever seen in his entire life.
And then on March 1st, 2010, Texas Governor Rick Perry pardoned your brother, his third wish. And then soon after that, the state of Texas passed the Timothy Cole Act, increasing compensation paid to exonerees after their release and adding compensation for the family of an exoneree cleared after death. Thank you to Rodney Ellis, who was a chair of the board of the Innocence Project of New York, who was instrumental in getting that passed. The state also created the Timothy Cole Advisory Panel on Wrongful Convictions in 2009 to study the prevention of wrongful convictions across the state. And ultimately, a 13-foot bronze statue of Tim in 2014 was dedicated in Lubbock, depicting young Tim looking toward Texas Tech University Law School, where he almost certainly would have graduated and gone on to do probably incredible things. And in his hands on the statue are two books. The binding of one says, Lest We Forget, and the base of the sculpture reads, And Justice for All. Wow. And Texas Tech University System Regents voted in 2015 to posthumously award Tim an honorary degree in law and social justice. What an incredible ending to the story. Before we get to the closing of the show, is there a call to action for the audience? Is there something that you'd like them to donate to or a website you'd like them to go to?
All of our work is focused on the Texas Innocence Project. So the incarcerated innocent, they need all the help they can get. There are more of them than there are people to help them. So anything you can do, anything you feel called to do to give to the Texas Innocence Project is greatly appreciated. Our family's mission is to continue to work on legislation through the Texas Innocence Project because there's still some things in the law that need to be changed.
And that's InnocenceTexas.org. That's InnocenceTexas.org. We'll also put a link in our bio for people to donate and get involved. So now, Karen and Corey, we have a tradition here at Wrongful Conviction, which is that the ending of our show is called Closing Arguments. It works like this. I, first of all, thank each of you, not just for being here today, but for just being such incredible fighters and courageous humans. I'm proud to know you and honored to have had you here today. So thank you for that. And then I'm going to turn my microphone off, turn my volume on my headphones up just a little bit, kick back in my chair and leave your mics on. And let's close out the show with any final thoughts you want to share. Who wants to go first? And then hand the mic off to your brother or sister, whoever it is. And then you can take us out into the sunset.
Well, I'll go first because my youngest brother is so eloquent. I'll leave the final words for him. Thank you, Jason, for having us today and for continuing to elevate these issues. I'm happy to be here to represent my brother and our family and to present our story of his case. But more than anything, I'm happy here to just let people know that we as a family stand on the shoulders of my brother and my mother, two wonderful people who were given circumstances beyond their control, but made the best of those circumstances. And I think have made a difference, not just in the state of Texas, but in the nation, in the criminal justice system. And so my final words to the listeners here today is that we still do have one of the best criminal justice systems, but it's just flawed, and that's okay. So I ask each of your listeners to take a moment and think about what is it you can do to make the system better, because there's always something that each of us can do to make it just a little better.
When Tim was in prison, he received back pay from the Army for some $14,000. It was all deposited into his inmate trust fund. And when his belongings came from prison after he had died, there was just a little box, and there was a check from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice Institutional Division, and it was for only $36 and some change. And some of my siblings were like, what in the world happened to all his money? What happened? And I remember a couple of days had gone by. My mother had organized all of his letters. And I was at her house. And I remember her yelling, Corey, Corey, come here. Come here. And I ran to the room. I said, what is it? And she was throwing some papers across her bed. And she said, he gave it away. My baby gave it all away, and there were receipts from the Catholic Charities, Feed the Children. He gave the bulk of his money to those in need. He knew he couldn't help himself, but he still had the power to help others. There are many people like Tim who are still in prison waiting to be cleared. In Texas, there are some 100-plus prisons. More than 60,000 inmates. The Texas Prosecutor County DA's Association, they say that the amount of innocent people in prison is as high as 10%. That's a lot of people. We have only scratched the surface. My mother, when she found out that the statue was going to be up, a reporter said, Ms. Session, how do you feel? Did you want to sue Lubbock for this? And she said, what I want, no man can give. And what I need is for them to never forget. So the baton is on us to make sure people never forget. We want to make sure that this does not happen to another family, that another man, another woman does not go to prison after serving his country, after just doing right, and the entire judicial system turn its back on him because they need a conviction. So we are thankful, we are grateful that he was cleared. But as my mom said, I never would have thought that on July 1st, 1960, that God would have chose me to be the vessel for change in the criminal justice system in Texas. My mother, when she first met Michelle, the rape victim, Michelle was crying on the front steps of my house. And my mother told her, stop crying. You have nothing to be sorry for. You were a victim just as Timothy was. And Michelle admired some heart-shaped earrings my mother had, and we had dinner at my house for about 3 hours, and it was like we were old friends. And when Michelle was leaving, my mother grabbed her arm and said, give me a hand. And she put her heart-shaped earrings in Michelle's hand. And she said, oh, Miss Session, I can't take this. She said, no, no. You give people their flowers while they're alive. So we will try and make sure we can give as many people their flowers in hopes of getting them exonerated, keeping them from going into the criminal justice system as best we can.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Justin Golden, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.